Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. In a few moments, I'll be shining the spotlight on the charism of John Paul II, in particular on the suffering of his latter years. I'll then be taking a look at Pope Benedict XVI's encyclical, Caritas in Veritate, with Dominican sister Helen Alford. And finally, joining our popular Latin lover on a guided tour of the Arch of Constantine. Well, thanks so much for joining me once again. As you know, John Paul II is going to be beatified on the 1st of May, Divine Mercy Sunday, by his successor to the See of Peter, Benedict XVI. And certainly in the weeks to come, we'll be taking a look in depth at the figure of this Polish saint-to-be. Beginning today, as I pick up on a conference focusing on the secret and essence of the holiness of John Paul II, held here in Rome at a pontifical university, the Regina Apostolorum. Key speaker at this conference is the postulator for the cause of the beatification and canonization of John Paul II, fellow Pole Sławomir Oder. A meeting this, organized by the Center for Studies John Paul II at this university, which has as its mission to promote research on the life, charism and works of this Pope. Inaugurated on the 18th of May 2010, to coincide with the 90th anniversary of the birth of Karol Wojtyła, the centre collects the writings and other print, photographic and audio-visual material concerning him. Writings which no doubt will eventually include correspondence addressed to the postulator of the cause of his beatification. Susie Hodges asked Father Oder about this correspondence.
Did you expect to get so many letters?
Well, I can see that it was predictable to receive all these letters because the Pope used to make so much good things. He loved so much everybody he met that now it is the fruit of his life.
Do most of these letters come from people saying they have been helped after praying for the intercession of Pope John Paul?
Most of these letters present graces received by the intercession of the Pope. But not only. Many persons simply want to make a courage to us and to say, well, we're going very well, working a good job, preparing the beatification of the Holy Father. So they want to encourage us to proceed.
Now we've listened to the postulator's words, I'd like to bring you a programme focusing on the latter years of this Roman Pontiff's pontificate, shining the spotlight in a special way on the impressive way he coped with suffering. Stay tuned for this feature I put together with exclusive sound from our Vatican Radio archives, but be sure to watch the change of pace. John Paul II, the first Pope ever to allow the world to scrutinise so closely physical failings. And as I'm about to bring you some brushstrokes from that canvas of physical failings, I'd like to begin with the days when his physical presence was strikingly strong. As indeed his voice brings home to one. The year is 1986, not even 10 years into his pontificate, the place Wellington, New Zealand. And as you'll hear in a few seconds, this athletic-looking Pope is speaking to the sick and suffering, thousands of them gathered around him, eager to glean a little reassurance and comfort.
It was the suffering and death of Christ that displayed the works of God most eloquently.
The Pope's voice is warm, betraying emotion, but above all perhaps empathy with those frailer members of society gathered around him. He relates to them effortlessly. After all, only 5 years earlier, this Polish Pope, an energetic sportsman brimming with health, had suddenly closed ranks with them, the physically suffering, It's a well-known story, one sprung on us on a sunny and relaxed spring afternoon of May 1981. The Pope stands, Samson-like and agile in his white cassock on a white jeep, in a crowded St. Peter's Square, athletically reaching out to make physical contact with as many of the pilgrims as possible, when out of the blue, gunshots ring out, wounded, he falters, is rushed to hospital. And from his hospital bed, he gains first-hand knowledge of what it means to be ill, deepening his insight into the effect physical suffering has on the human psyche, an awareness expressed half a decade later in New Zealand.
Perhaps some of you may ask God why you have been singled out for a life that is different from the lives of other people.
This dilemma, so common among those who suffer, is one he addresses in the very next breath.
But in the providence of God, a different life does not mean a less important life. It does not mean a life with less potential for holiness or for contributing to the well-being of the world.
What Pope John Paul didn't know at the time he pronounced these words was to what extent his own life would be physically affected by suffering. How he would return to hospital 7 times, how the signs of suffering would slowly begin to affect his daily gestures. How the press would zoom in with their cameras scrutinising his physical failings. From his inability to stoop and kiss the soil of a nation when he travelled, to the shaky hand when he read his speeches, and his incapacity to walk, to correctly pronounce words. But what this Pope always knew was that he was firm in his faith, never faltering in his commitment as head of the Catholic Church, even from his sickbed. Ever since that first time he was admitted to hospital as one of the cardinals to elect him Pope, American William Wakefield Baum recounts.
While he was in the hospital, during the period of recuperation, perhaps you know, he received all of the cardinals of the Curia, one by one. He would inquire of us what was going on. He wanted to know, be brought up to date on how things were moving. And then he encouraged us and reminded us all that he was offering his sufferings also for the work of his colleagues who were serving him and serving the church. And we experienced that very much, the effects of his prayerful suffering for us.
Prayerful suffering, best symbolized for me in that image of Pope John Paul II praying, visibly in difficulty, in the Lourdes Grotto in August 2004. An image starkly cruel, showing him slipping to the ground as he knelt. One in strong contrast with modern trends where the rule of thumb is to hide all physical failing. But one reflecting a powerful witness to spiritual and moral strength, forged, perhaps, in the early stages of his life, at a personal level, with first the loss of his mother at the age of 10 and the death of his brother just into his teens, and more broadly by the harsh scenario of the world surrounding him as a young man, the wartime experience, the years of concealment and resistance, under first the Nazis and then the communists.
Do not be afraid when love requires sacrifice. Do not be afraid of the cross of Christ. The cross is the tree of life. It is the source of all joy and peace.
Do not be afraid, a message Pope John Paul II incessantly repeated ever since the early days of his pontificate. And in the latter years, as the physically ailing pontiff was handed over to the arms of infirmity, He may no longer have been able to pronounce these words with force, but he forcefully showed the world he was not afraid, how suffering, rather than vanquish his vigour, gave him powerful inner strength to lead the Catholic Church. Moving to hear this late Pope's voice once again. Now coming up next in the broadcast, here in the Vatican this week from Thursday to Friday, the Pontifical Council for Justice and Peace is holding a seminar by the title of Logic of Gift, which takes a look at how the ideas Pope Benedict XVI illustrated in his social encyclical Caritas in Veritate, or Charity in Truth, published in the summer of 2009, can have a practical application in times of continuing economic hardship. Among the participants are both professors and business practitioners, including the Dean of the Faculty of Social Sciences at the Pontifical University of St. Thomas here in Rome. She is Professor of Economics and Business Ethics, Dominican Sister Helen Alford. In a few moments, she'll help us better understand this social encyclical.
You don't associate economics and politics with truth and charity.
It's one of our big problems of the modern age, that on the one hand, we have tremendous developments in terms of technical developments, financial instruments, all kinds of new ideas on the technical level, but they've become disconnected from social life. And as a result, a bit like this technocentric technology we were talking about before, they all too easily become the dominant factor in our life. So people live to work. Instead of work being for life, life is for work. Instead of money being for greater intrinsic goods, it becomes the goal. And we just try to get as much money as possible and become very unhappy as a result. Now, economists and some of the people who've been working on this, whose hand you can see in this encyclical, are very aware about this, and they are trying to change their models. There's a whole area of research now in economics called happiness economics, and they're trying to understand what are the components of happiness within an economic framework. It might sound a bit funny to most people, but it's an interesting attempt on their part. They realize that economics has to connect again back to these ultimate goods, which of course the most important are charity and truth, as pointed out in this encyclical, but also things like human happiness would also be part of that, intrinsic goods for us. It's not a surprise that when they go out and they do these surveys around the world, that the countries that they find are the most happy in their empirical research are usually the poorer countries. I remember one time Mexico came at the top of the list. You never get a big advanced economy as one of the most happy countries in the world. You tend to find the suicide rates, for instance, are much higher in advanced economies than in poorer countries. So on the one hand, we want economic development because we don't want people dying of starvation or because they don't have access to health care. But we also don't want this at the cost of creating people who are unhappy, who don't see the goal in life, who have lost connection with these ultimate values. And that's really what this encyclical is about. It's about connecting economics and development back to these ultimate values, the highest of which are
charity and truth.
But there are lots of others as well. And I think another, if I can just add a little rider to that, another important point about this encyclical is that it emphasizes what we might call this third sector of activity. You know, we're used to thinking in our economic and social schemes about the market and the state. So the market does certain things and the state does certain things. And this encyclical points out, as has been happening for a long time, but it's now very good that it's come so clearly into the social teaching, that there's an important third sector, which is this group of very diverse organizations, like cultural organizations that are producing education, or they're non-profits, they're non-governmental organizations, they're working on human rights, they're producing all kinds of other value in our economy that neither the state nor the market can produce. And yet they're really important in terms of connecting again.
But they're fringe component now.
Well, they're fringe in terms of people's thinking, but I'm not sure that they're fringe in terms of their actual impact in real life. I mean, this is why that aspect of the encyclical is important, because what it will do now is focus the work of economists who were interested in social teaching on learning more about this sphere and integrating it better into the way we think about social systems and economic systems.
So really, in this encyclical, from what you're saying, there's a long-term vision. It's no longer philanthropy, almsgiving to those who are the most needy, but trying to include them rather in the main system.
Yeah, I think there's both there, because I think we don't want to lose the fact that there are always going to be poor people in need of immediate help. But that is not the only way of helping people. The much more dignified way of helping people is to provide them with the tools where they can provide for their own development. So, you know, human dignity requires that we do that too. But then if people are in crisis or in difficulty, you know, aid and charity and that is also very important. So we don't want to negate the first, but we want to add the second.
You just mentioned the word development. That word comes up a lot in this encyclical. We hear about human and economic development, and again, development of people and peoples. This is a key word in the encyclical, isn't it?
Oh, yes, surely. Partly because the whole idea of the encyclical is to reflect, again, 40 years on, on this, the important encyclical of Paul VI, Populorum Progressio, which had development as its key idea. So it's a re-reading of that encyclical in the light of the current circumstances and bringing in our current ideas and new ideas that can help deepen our understanding of that.
Pope dedicates a whole chapter to Populorum Progressio, in which Paul VI talked about the scandal of glaring inequalities of peoples in that encyclical. But that was in the 1960s, when words are like globalization and this current financial crisis were out of the picture. So I think people were surprised that he latched on to that particular encyclical, no? Social encyclical.
Well, yeah, that's an interesting point you make. But a bit like the way popes often, well, always, in fact, remember Rerum Novarum, which is an even older encyclical, you know, 1891, they keep going back to it. This is the same kind of idea. We go back to this idea of development because although the context in which Paul VI was writing is very different, the idea that human development should be at the centre of our social and economic thinking and that it should be connected with our faith and that it should be seen in the light of the gospel and that charity and truth are integrally related to it, these ideas are perennial. These are always going to be important for us, and we're going to need to be reminded about them, especially because we live in such a technically advanced society today. It's all too easy to lose the vision of these perennial values because we get so caught up with the details of these wonderful systems, which are really interesting and fascinating, but they don't have any meaning unless we connect them to these higher perennial goods.
And warm thanks there to the Dean of the Faculty of Social Sciences at the Pontifical University of St. Thomas here in Rome, Dominican Sister Helen Alford. Time to join our popular Latin lover, Carmelite Father Reginald Foster, as I meet up with him right next to the Colosseum, by a famous archway, which one used to drive through in a not-so-remote past, and which today is simply a place for visitors to admire. And for lovers of all things Latin, to discover more about. I've just met up with Carmelite Father Reggie Foster outside the Colosseum. Father Reggie Foster is a Latinist. He's actually a Vatican Latinist. Father, we're standing here looking at the Arch of Constantine. This is a sort of a focal point in Christian history, isn't it? It represents something very special, a victory of an emperor, a very special emperor for Christian history.
Well, yes, the one who more or less who recognized Christianity as a religion. And so he stopped all the persecutions against Christianity. And up there you see on top, it's written in Latin, Instinctu Divinitatis. He conquered his enemy Maxentius, who was like the rival emperor, under divine inspiration. That's the famous time where they said up on the Ponte Milvio near the north of Rome, he saw the cross in the sky.
Yeah, maybe our listeners don't know. I've heard about it, but maybe our listeners
anyway,
don't
there's
know.
The famous, it's kind of a, well, it's really kind of a fable, but anyway, that he saw the cross in the sky, and in written in Greek, although it's quoted in Latin, in hoc signo vinces, you will conquer in this sign. He had the Christian cross put on the shields of all of his soldiers.
Really?
Yes, that's the idea. And then
that's a part of the legend.
That's yeah. And then with these soldiers under the, as the Constantine art says, instinctu divinitatis, under the inspiration of the divinity, he conquered Maxentius and became the sole emperor of the Roman world. And because of this Christian business and this cross and so forth and so on, he was favorable toward Christianity and allowed it to exist as a religion.
This arch is an arch of triumph in battle, really, isn't it? That's what it represents. Yes. Our listeners can't see it, so should we describe it? It's a marble structure, isn't it? Or is it in travertine?
Yeah, travertine, yes. And the fact is that you have pieces from many, many monuments in Rome that he collected and put together. And so you have pictures there of the emperor, like offering sacrifice of thanksgiving. I see on the left-hand side there are two pictures of the emperor there.
There are three arches, and the one on the left-hand has this relief over it.
Yes, these are two reliefs. And on the other side, he's addressing the soldiers over there. But these things are not his. They were taken from other emperors' monuments. So he collected all kinds of ruins around the city and pasted this thing together. So it all looks, you could always say it all looks like Constantine and Let It Be.
That's a very Roman habit, isn't it? To pilfer from older buildings and them into newer ones.
Up to papal times, you know. Because they figure what was gone, and now we're in charge now. And so we will use the best things that other people had for our own good purposes. So that's the important thing of the Constantine. It's being restored for a number of years now. And we hope it'll be finished someday soon.
I think Constantine was the first emperor to actually have basilicas built.
Then he started, yes, the three, the old St. Peter's and all St. Paul's outside the walls. He had those first things. If I'm not mistaken, he also started St. Lawrence, if I'm not mistaken. The first original building of St. Lawrence is also Constantine.
But is this proceeding? So does this precede the basilicas or not? Does this arch precede the basilicas or not?
No, this came after, because most of these arches, you know, were dedicated by the Senate after the deaths of emperors, and so as to celebrate his whole life. And so he had all these different things he did in his life for Christianity or for the Roman Empire and Constantinople and all that stuff. And then they put up this arch to celebrate him.
Who did it exactly?
Well, the Senate, you know, the Senate after his time.
No one in particular?
No. Like up there, you saw the Arch of Titus. You know,
that's on the Sacred Way.
That was put up after his death because he's already divinized. It's Divine Titus. And, of course, that title was given to the Senate, which means after his death he was canonized. You see, you probably realize the Christians should understand that Constantine in the Eastern Church is considered a saint. In the Western Church, we don't consider him Saint Constantine. And the fact is, you know, that's another kind of a fable, that he was baptized on his deathbed, which is kind of like a convenient thing. And you have the famous statue there of Bernini in the Vatican. And above the statue of Bernini, of Constantine on his horse, as he sees the cross in the sky, is a picture of his being baptized by Saint Sylvester, Pope Sylvester. And they say kind of the last minutes of his life, if it's even true, that he was ever baptized a Christian is another question. But that.
Heartfelt thanks there, as always, to my favourite Carmelite, his popular Latin lover, Father Reginald Foster. Finally, why not end on a Franciscan note by joining me this time in a place linked to St. Francis here in Rome, as I go on a discovery tour there with Professor of Fine Arts, Breda Ennis. We're in a chapel above the main church of San Francesco a Ripa, Breda. We're sitting on chairs in a room where St. Francis once lived. Yes. No?
He's believed to have stayed here when he came to Rome with also another member of his order, Brother Leo. And actually what we see here, this small room, this rectangular room, in effect was actually originally two cells. And afterwards they were put together and the little chapel was made of the entire space. So here you can see these nude walls that go back to the 13th century.
And slightly charred, no?
Yes, in fact, it's sort of weather-worn, but in a nice sense. And inside a little grating on the right-hand side of the altar, there is a stone which apparently St. Francis used as a cushion when he stayed here. So the whole place is permeated with the feeling of St. Francis, because people generally go to places like Gubbio and Assisi, etc. But here in Rome is this hidden little place of St. Francis of Assisi where I think a real tranquility, a real peace has remained, regardless of a busy, bustling city outside. So here you have this little treasure area. The actual chapel itself, in my feeling, is a reliquary in itself, more than being just a sanctuary or a chapel. It's actually, we're inside a relic, in a way. But additions which were made to this little space, this nude space, at a later stage in the Baroque period, they built a type of, let's say, a reasonably simple altar made of wood, mahogany, and you can see a big panel area behind. In the middle, you can see a painting of St. Francis of Assisi. It's a copy of what was supposed to be an original painting of what St. Francis of Assisi actually looked like. So this was done in the 13th or 14th century. They don't have an exact date for it. And it was done by Mangiaritone of Arezzo. You have this slim figure in the middle with this beautiful cross in his hand, the red one, wearing his Franciscan robes. And again, the hands are very simple. You feel like you're on the threshold between sort of late medieval painting and you're moving into the area where you're going towards Giotto and where you're going into the Renaissance eventually, and where you get movement into the figures, because there's a certain pathos, simplicity and beauty in this painting. Not too many things are added to it. It's just very simply St. Francis holding the list of the regulations of his order in his hand, the cross in the other. You see behind it is a gold background again, which is like the Byzantine background, which represents eternity, the celestial sphere, where we now use blue a lot for that. They used gold to pull you into something that was beyond your life. And the magic trick, amazing part of this little chapel is when they move a piece of equipment behind the altar inside a tiny little cupboard, the whole place behind the altar opens up into various little sections, and out pop about 1,000 relics.
It's one of Rome's best kept secrets, isn't it?
Well, yeah. So it's like a massive, gigantic reliquary with all kinds of saints' relics, and a lot of them relating to the various saints as well in the Franciscan order. It's all done in wood, and you have wooden curtains, let's say, with sort of golden trestles. You have angels holding up the curtains as if they're trying to reveal the treasures that are behind inside the cupboard. It's extraordinary. And also the wood is very rich, rich mahogany and gold. And again, as you come back from the altar, you can see the candles, the candelabra, which is a long, slim candelabra, over the altar, at least, let's say, reasonably near the altar, but to be exact. Again, in this wonderful gold, I get the feeling that something of the gold quality of the spirit of St. Francis is permeating the entire room, helping you to relate to these relics, but more important, in my opinion, is to bring yourself into contact with that special piece that is absolutely distinctive for St. Francis of Assisi. It's a kind of peace you feel in every place where he's been, and you can really feel it here. That's the greatest treasure that he has left behind, the spiritual peace that you can actually feel.
And warm thanks there to Professor Breda Ennis. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick, and that brings me up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. Laudetur Jesus Christus.